From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and it was Hurricane Hermine. It is now Tropical Storm Hermine, but still a dangerous storm lashing the east coast of the U.S. Rain is falling in the southeast, and as the storm heads up the east coast, there are new fears that it will stall off of New Jersey, maybe for days, so we'll keep an eye on that.
But right now, let's get to the political winds, shifting and otherwise. Today, the Nonpartisan Commission on Presidential Debates announced that NBC's Lester Holt will host the first presidential debate next month. CNN's Anderson Cooper and ABC's Martha Raddatz will team up to host the second. It's a town hall-style debate. The third will be hosted by Fox News' Chris Wallace. The one vice presidential debate will be hosted by Elaine Quijano of CBS News. How much of this past week's news, a trip to Mexico for Trump, extraordinary fundraising for Clinton, will we even remember then? So much comes out of this spigot we call Campaign 2016. So let's get started.
Here and now,
2016.
Joining us now, Maria Elena Salinas, Univision News Anchor. Hi, Maria Elena.
Hello, good morning.
It's great to talk to you. It's great to have you once again. And Rebecca Cinderbrand, who is managing editor of The Fix at The Washington Post, is with us as well. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing well. And let me start by asking both of you what you thought about Trump's immigration speech on Wednesday night. And let's listen to a clip of it.
We are going to end catch and release. We catch them. Oh, go ahead. We catch them. Go ahead. Under my administration, anyone who illegally crosses the border will be detained until they are removed out of our country and back to the country from which they came.
Maria Elena, what did you think of that speech and what did it do to his campaign?
I still have a little bit of indigestion from the time that I heard the speech. It was a bomb. It was a nuclear bomb. You know, there were actually people who thought that he would soften his stance after meeting with his Latino Advisory Council, because he had finally realized that he couldn't win without the support of Latino voters. But instead, he doubled, tripled, quadrupled down on his anti-immigrant rhetoric. And you just heard it. It was the tone. The tone was angry and full of hatred, much, much stronger than when we heard him in June of last year when he launched his campaign, accusing Mexicans of bringing in criminals and rapists and drug dealers.
Right. And Rebecca, what did you think?
You know, it's interesting. In the days leading up to it, one of the reasons some people had assumed that Donald Trump might think about softening up his rhetoric beyond the fact that there had been hints from his surrogates and the political reasons was because that actually was possible at some point. There was a period of time where over several days he seemed to echo the views of the last person that he spoke with, according to people close to the campaign. Someone would speak to him and say something that was harder line, and he would echo that. And then someone would speak to him with perhaps advice to soften, and he would echo them. And finally, what appears to have happened is that a group of advisors that hold these harder line positions came to him and made the case, look, you have to, you know, the old rule in politics, dance with the one that brung you. Basically, you know, his base wants to hear this. He has to stick with what got him to where he is.
Well, of course, it's much more complicated than we've even laid out, because this speech, and many are saying it wasn't a speech, it was a rally, came after the meeting with Mexico's president. And there's huge disagreement about what was said there. But he seemed, Trump did, seem to contradict what he said while standing next to the president. He seemed to contradict that when we came back to this huge rally. And the rally attendance seemed to respond. There was a moment during the speech, it's happened at others, when a Trump supporter urged violence against Hillary Clinton. Let's listen.
Hillary Clinton has pledged to keep both of these illegal amnesty programs, including the 2014 amnesty, which has been blocked by the United States Supreme Court. Great. Clinton has also pledged...
String her up. You could hear it there shouted out. And many have criticized Donald Trump for not reacting, not doing the John McCain way when he told a supporter, no, that's not true, when she made a comment about President Obama. And this just after he appeared presidential, standing next to the president of Mexico. Maria Elena, your thoughts on this? It's a Jekyll Hyde.
Well, I think he was trying to have it both ways. And what he was trying to do is appeal to his base, because by going to Mexico City, he's not really attracting anyone other than his base, which sees it as a very bold move on his part. But then he goes back and he is completely ignoring the moderates, the independents, including some of his Latino supporters who the day after decided to abandon him because of the tone of that speech. But I guess maybe he doesn't understand that, you know, the primaries are over. He's already won the nomination and his base is going to be there no matter what he does or what he says. Like he said at one point, if I can shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and people will still support me. And that is true. But he can't win the election without those independents, without those Republican moderates, without some Democrats that are disappointed with Hillary Clinton, without minorities, without women.
But why is he then so close in the polls? That's what everyone says. But why are the polls so close?
Well, the polls are closed because Hillary has had very bad few weeks after her convention. The email scandal continues to drag on and on and on. And she also has more competition from the Libertarian and the Green Party candidates who, when you look at the matchups between just Trump and Hillary, she is usually more ahead than when you include the other two candidates. And I think that's one of the reasons why she's just laying low. She doesn't want to have to continue talking about the email scandal and is kind of hoping that eventually he will implode. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that the new set of polls that we see in the future are going to be a little bit different, because I think he did, after that speech, after that very loud and very nasty and angry speech, some are calling it a hate speech, he will lose more supporters.
Well, Rebecca, I want to ask you about Hillary Clinton, but actually first, just real quick, which polls should we be looking at? The ones that have all four of the candidates or the ones that just have Trump and Clinton?
Well, you know, not to kind of dismiss the national polls entirely, but I would say none of those. I would say look at the polls in the swing states. That is where you have to keep your eye. The national numbers, you know, it gives us a good sense of where the country as a whole is, and it can give us a sense of kind of the big picture, where people are in terms of the personal qualities of the candidates and the enthusiasm, and that's very helpful. But we really have to look at, you know, counting up where the electoral votes are, looking at Ohio, Pennsylvania,
right.
Wisconsin.
But the polls in those swing states with all four candidates, or the polls just with Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton?
And, you know, what's interesting is Hillary Clinton has been ahead, of course, in both. And in some, this has been odd, in a couple of states, we've actually seen where there are all four candidates.
Right.
There were one or two polls where she was even further ahead of Trump, perhaps because some of the third party candidates were drawing more from Trump than they were from her. So, you know, it's not necessarily that much of a distinguisher at this point. There has not yet been a poll, with the possible exception of a state like New Mexico, where, of course, Gary Johnson used to be governor and is drawing a significant percentage of the vote. But there hasn't really been a state where you can say the third party candidates have had a significant impact, a game changing impact on the vote as yet.
Well, where has Hillary Clinton been? I mean, she only had one major public appearance this week. It was a speech to the American Legion National Convention. Here she is referring to Trump and his visit to Mexico.
People have to get to know that they can count on you, that you won't say one thing one day and something totally different the next. And it certainly takes more than trying to make up for a year of insults and insinuations by dropping in on our neighbors for a few hours and then flying home again. That is not how it works.
Maria Elena, is it a mistake for Hillary Clinton to kind of be outside of the spotlight?
Well, it is, because that's what people are talking about. You know, people are talking about and counting the amount of days since the last press conference that she had, since the last major interview that she had. So it does look bad, but I guess that they are trying to weigh what is worse, having to again talk about this email issue that is constantly dragging on, talking about the Clinton Foundation and the donors to the Clinton Foundation and the conflict that has created, or go ahead and just stay lay low and, like I said before, just allow Donald Trump to implode. So I think that that's a strategy. And, you know, there's always October surprises and we never know what each one of
them
has.
We've had one every month.
For October. That's true. I know we can't really talk. What's interesting about this election is that we can't really talk about tradition. We can't talk about, you know, go back to history and see how things have gone in the past. Because it's an unconventional election.
Speaking of unconventional, we only have about a minute, but Rebecca, just comment briefly on Donald Trump's efforts to reach the African-American community. The New York Times reports on a script that Trump is apparently going to use when he meets with an African-American pastor in Detroit tomorrow, a meeting that's set to be televised in the future. The answers for Trump are written in. Why is he going to the African-American community? It seems like a big ask.
Well, and you have to remember, again, that this is actually a scaled-down event. He was originally supposed to have a much larger profile, a public event. That's no longer taking place. And so, you know, again, it's this fits and starts and outreach to the Hispanic community, to the African-American community. And the real audience, of course, is not necessarily African-Americans, but white suburban voters who are uncomfortable with Donald Trump's message and don't feel it's inclusive enough.
Rebecca Cinderbrand, managing editor of The Fix It with The Washington Post. Maria Elena Salinas, a Univision News anchor. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you for
having us. My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, now let's take a trip to Alaska. Every year, dozens of researchers spend their summers on a giant ice field, a high-elevation stretch of snow and ice just north of Juneau. The Juneau Ice Field Research Program has been around for about 70 years, at first exploring the icy surface, but now tracking the rate at which glaciers are shrinking. Wouldn't you love to go? Well, from member station KTOO in Juneau, Elizabeth Jenkins learned what scientists and students do at Camp 18.
If you squint, you might think you're in the desert. Flat white terrain stretches out as far as the eye can see, and rocky peaks dot the horizon. The people, too, appear to be dressed for warm weather. Most are wearing running shorts and t-shirts, their eyes hidden behind sunglasses to block the glare from snow. Olivia Truax, a recent graduate from Amherst College, says she can't imagine her peers would join her on the Juneau ice field.
Probably not. One of my friends was dropping me off at the airport, and she was like, yeah, I mean, you're off to spend your summer on the ice doing science and skiing and digging. That sounds like my personal hell, but have fun.
But Truax and the others are clearly having a good time. They're digging a hole in the snow that's so deep, they had to develop a special strategy. Rather than dropping straight down, the pit resembles a Tetris piece. And working together, each person shovels the snow and ice onto the next platform. This isn't boot camp. This is science. By the end of the day, they'll reach last year's snow surface, which will allow them to measure how much snow is above it and determine how much the ice field is gaining or losing.
With some fancy math and weather data, we can figure out at the end of the summer how much snow might be left.
That's Annika Ord. She's on safety staff. The program has the oldest mass balance record in North America, a record of how the Juneau ice field, which feeds more than 30 major glaciers, is changing. Miles away from the snow pit is Camp 18. It's a rustic collection of bunkhouses where students and scientists live during their stay, and it feels like it's on top of the world. On a clear day, you can see where glaciers meet and flow down the valley. Like Olivia Truax, you would expect most of the people who attend this program to describe themselves as outdoorsy, but not Joel Gonzalez Santiago.
No, not even a little bit. I prefer to be indoors with my computer and maybe some nice music, just kind of in a controlled temperature.
Gonzalez Santiago is a junior at Elizabeth City State University in North Carolina and a business major. He learned about the program through an academic advisor and decided to give it a shot. He's logged a lot of firsts. First time camping overnight, first time seeing skis, first time traveling long distances on skis.
Back at home, I walk a total of maybe a mile, and that's to like get from my house to my car, and then from the car to the parking lot, and then from the parking lot to school. So it's different. I've never done anything like this before.
To get to the 1,500-square-mile ice field, students take a trail behind Juneau's Home Depot. The multi-day trek involves hiking up steep terrain, climbing.
Step, 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 breathe, step, 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 breathe.
And eventually skiing on top of glaciers. Gonzalez Santiago says to get through it, he had to get out of his own head. But he doesn't regret spending a summer on ice. He's excited to send photos of his goggle tan and the landscape back to his grandma in Puerto Rico and explain to his family what climate change means, that some of the glaciers, where he just spent nearly 2 months, are disappearing.
Yeah, I can show them and say, I've witnessed this, I see it, you know, you can't deny it.
This summer, the youngest person on the ice field is fresh out of high school. And the oldest person?
Well, I won't tell you that.
Alf Pinchak has been coming here since the 1960s. He says when he was a research fellow with the National Science Foundation, it was glacial streams, not human-caused climate change, that caught his attention. Pinchak now helps maintain a project that measures the year-round temperature at some of the camps, and he doesn't think this will be his last trip.
If you read through the Robert Surface poems about this kind of country, I think you'll come to understand, you know, why people come back here. It's the great big broad land way up yonder. It's the forest where silence has lease. It's the beauty that thrills me with wonder. It's the stillness that fills me with peace.
Back at the dig, the group has carved out a pit in the snow that's at least as deep as a few flights of stairs. It's hours of labor, but Olivia Truax doesn't seem to mind. She says it's a cool feeling to contribute to such a long-running record.
But also can be kind of sad when I think about the way that our models say the Juneau Ice Field will be in another 70 years.
Truax imagines for her own kids someday, the ice field will be a different place. In about 200 years, scientists have said it's possible the ice field could be gone altogether. For Here and Now, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
And Elizabeth's story comes to us from Alaska's Energy Desk, a public media collaboration focused on energy and the environment.
And speaking of Alaska, it'll soon have a new resident, our summer intern based in Washington, Avery Lill, who graduated from Baylor in the spring. And she's headed to Dillingham, Alaska, to report for NPR station KDLG. Thanks, Avery, for all your good work, and have a great time in Alaska.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron, helping you make delicious home-cooked meals by sourcing from a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, you choose from a range of recipes that can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Pre-measured ingredients delivered to your door only when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping at Blue Apron. blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here.
Melania Trump has filed a lawsuit against the British tabloid The Daily Mail and an American blogger for publishing articles alleging she worked as an escort in the 1990s and for raising questions about when she first came to the U.S. And both The Daily Mail and the blogger have retracted their stories. Trump's lawyer called the statements 100% false and tremendously damaging to her personal and professional reputation and said she's seeking $150 million in damages. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik is here. And David, since both outlets have retracted their articles, we don't want to go into too much detail, but what is Mrs. Trump upset about?
Well, as you can tell from reading through the complaint filed by Melania Trump's lawyers, they're upset fundamentally. They say that she's been defamed by claims in these posts and articles that she was involved in modeling agencies that served as escort services and the easy implications one can draw from that claim. And they're saying that, you know, she worked as a model and that she had a professional career at that time and that these articles are false and defamatory. Yeah. So they've filed suit there in Montgomery County, Maryland.
Well, we know the Daily Mail. It's a tabloid. Who is the blogger?
Blogger's a guy by the name of Webster Griffin Tarpley, operates out of Gaithersburg, Maryland. Not somebody I'm hugely familiar with, but has trafficked in the past significantly in conspiracy theories. Apparently ran for office under the Lyndon LaRouche ticket. Gives you some idea of sort of the political viewpoints or kinds of ideas he may traffic in, and the question of how closely they are tethered to fact. In this case, of course, Trump's lawyers arguing not very closely at all.
Yeah. Well, the Daily Mail wrote in their retraction that they only aired these allegations to ask the question, would they affect the campaign? But any reports and pictures of Melania Trump as a model seem to be received here with a big yawn. I mean, has it affected the campaign?
I think the most damaging thing involving Melania Trump has been in some ways the question of her immigration status and whether or not she was here when she first operated in the mid-90s as a model under the kind of visa that would allow her to do that, whether she was functioning as a tourist, whether she had an H-1B, some other kind of visa that would allow her to operate here. She said and has said a number of times that she was here, you know, operating the way the system was supposed to work and was very careful to observe that. But obviously, immigration is such a core part of the Trump appeal to many voters and a core part of his platform that any subterfuge on that level might be something that could alienate voters.
Yeah. Well, this isn't Donald Trump's or the Trump's first time suing reporters. Melania Trump has been represented by the lawyer who recently represented Hulk Hogan in his lawsuit against Gawker, which ultimately led to the company going bankrupt, the site shutting down. So your thoughts, how this will play out?
Well, I think the through line here is the desire to inflict pain. You know, Donald Trump once sued Tim O'Brien at the time with the New York Times for a biography in which O'Brien, among other things, questioned how much wealth Trump actually had. And in interviews with the Washington Post and other places, Trump has said he essentially did it to try to bleed O'Brien financially, to make it hurt for the publication, but particularly for the journalists involved. So I think this is a shot across the bow not only of the Daily Mail, but of others that might seek to publish unflattering articles. Even if in this instance, even the Daily Mail is not saying it could really substantiate the kinds of claims that circulated.
David Folkenflik, NPR's media correspondent. David, thanks as always.
You bet.
It's time now for another edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
And there goes the last DJ.
Joining us now is Raul Campos, who is a DJ at KCRW. He's with us from Santa Monica. Hi, Raul.
How's it going?
It's going well. It's great to have you as we kind of wind down the summer, getting into Labor Day weekend here. And let's get to some of the music that you have for us today. This is Father John Misty with his latest single, Real Love Baby.
Aha, I'm free. So tell me what's wrong with you.
Kind of a 60s or 70s quality to that. Tell us about this one.
Well, I love the song. This is actually my favorite song at the moment. Jay Tillman, drummer for Fleet Foxes, Josh Tillman, is Father John Misty, and he put up the song up on SoundCloud back in May. And yeah, it definitely has this throwback 60s sound, but it's just gorgeous. And he's talking about the birds and the bees, so, you know, what else could be better than that?
Well, and he has an interesting story. He was raised by evangelical Christians in Maryland, but obviously this is not Christian rock.
No, here he's really talking about, you know, learning to surrender yourself to love and your partner, your wife, your husband, whatever it may be. And I love his lyrics, his songwriting ability, and of course when he actually sings these songs for a drummer. I mean, I think he's got great vocal skills.
All right, well, next we have a song from the British duo Massive Attack. We've had them on the DJ sessions before. Here's The Spoils featuring the singer Hope Sandoval.
Some sentimental tears or someone else's girl that drifts away. But I somehow slowly love you.
Very warm vocals there, kind of cinematic too. What's going on here?
Well, Hope Sandoval from Mazzy Star has collaborated with Massive Attack over the years many times. The last one was with a tune called Paradise Circus, which was more of a almost a dance tune. And to get this kind of lush, kind of just tripped out tune called The Spoils, it's Massive Attack at their finest. Their production skills are ridiculously cool. And you put Hope Sandoval on the vocals, you can't go wrong. It's a match made in heaven there.
I will say it is very different than the other song from Massive Attack that we've had on, and I know that you guys like to play on KCRW, which is Ritual Spirit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ritual Spirit is their latest EP. These are a couple more songs that have been floated out. I'm hoping there's an actual album to come soon. And we've been following them for quite some time.
All right, well, let's pick up the pace a little with this next track. This is Youth by the Oxford-based band Glass Animals. This song is on their second album, How to Be a Human Being, which actually came out this week.
Mm-hmm. It's you know, when a band comes out with their debut full length and they basically practice their songs for an entire lifetime and then they finally come out with an album, it's great and it gets acclaim, and the song Gooey was really cool from the last album, but then they get kind of thrown into the mix and okay, you got to follow up with a new album. And they were actually just in the studios of KCRW, and during the performance, during the interview, it was asked, like, you know, where did the stories come up for these songs? And David, the lead singer, is all like, it's our life experiences, the people that we've encountered on tour and on the road. It's kind of like this cool kind of arc that talks about life experiences and where they've been, where they're going, and what they hope to accomplish.
All right, well, a lot of people will be familiar with the next band, which is Wilco. Here is the song Someone to Lose off their latest album called Schmilka. Still got that Wilco sound after all these years.
Jeff Tweedy, I think, is one of the most prolific songwriters of our time. And, you know, the feel of the detuned guitars and the throwback. I mean, this kind of sounds almost Beatlesque. But, you know, Schmilko is coming out, I think, September 9th. And they've already thrown out three of the songs. And this third one is really cool. And I like the way they're just kind of talking about that. Sometimes you're just kind of clueless and wandering aimlessly, not knowing exactly where you're going. But, you know, you got to kind of keep trucking and keep the dream alive, kind of thing.
All right, well, we have time for one more, Raul, and this is very timely given what has just happened in the last couple weeks. This is the group Ozo Motley from Los Angeles. Here's the song El Noa Noa from their forthcoming album Nonstop, and I'll explain the connection in a minute. Cuando quieras tú divertirte más y bailar sin fin, yo sé de un lugar que te llevaré y disfrutaré. Now, this is a cover of a song by the Mexican singer Juan Gabriel, who, as we know, unfortunately just passed away.
Yeah, he passed away at the age of 66 on Sunday. And, you know, Juan Gabriel to any Latino Mexican is like the equivalent of Michael Jackson, David Bowie, Elton John, kind of all mixed together almost. Yeah. I mean, this guy is prolific. 2,000 songs that he published, wrote for so many people like Rocío Dúrcal, Ana Gabriel, and now Ozzy Osbourne kind of paying homage and celebrating the music of not just Juan Gabriel, but the whole album Nonstop is a tribute full length, basically honoring a lot of their inspirations over the years. And these guys are known kind of as LA's party band, but doing a cover of El Noa Noa from Juan Gabriel is just very, very touching. And they had already recorded this song months ago. So it's not just like they just did it because he passed away. This was already done already at least a few months back.
That's Raul Campos, DJ at KCRW, with some of his favorite songs of the moment. Raul, thanks so much as always.
Well, thank you for having me.
And you can hear all our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. Just go to Spotify and search for NPR Here and Now. You can also find us on Apple Music or at hereandnow.org.
This summer has been tough with record heat and drought, floods, wildfires. Well, today we want to remember another hard summer 200 years ago and one that changed American history. It was 1816, and it wasn't the heat people endured. It was bitter cold. There was frost and snow all summer long because of what we now call a natural disaster, but what may have been a first taste of how a changing climate can affect our lives. Brian Mann with Here and Now contributor North Country Public Radio has the story.
This dirt road winds through the middle of Old Sturbridge Village in Massachusetts. It's a loving recreation of life in the Northeast in the 19th century. And everything here is tied back to the land, tied to the seasons, tied to the harvest. But in the summer of 1816, that cycle collapsed.
Seasons seem to go backwards.
Tom Kelleher is a historian here. He meets me in the tailed jacket and waistcoat that a local farmer would have worn in 1816. He says by early summer of that year, Americans knew something terrible was happening.
Seeing people in their overcoats in June working in the fields with mittens on, which is ridiculous, because usually in June it's going to be 80 degrees or better.
Winter kept coming back, laying waste to farm fields, turning leaves on the fruit trees black.
Frost and snow and rain and ice forming on ponds, snow falling even into June, July, August in some places.
News accounts from the time describe an elderly man nearly dying, lost in a midsummer blizzard. Frozen birds dropped out of the sky in Montreal. As far south as Virginia, Thomas Jefferson wrote in his diary that the cold had killed his fruit and tobacco crops. The culprit, it turns out, was on the far side of the planet.
Tamboro would be the biggest impact from a volcanic eruption pretty much in written history.
Environmental historian and climatologist Kurt Steger is a professor at Paul Smith College in New York. He says the Tambora eruption in Indonesia a year earlier in 1815 spread a kind of sun filter that lingered in the upper atmosphere.
Tiny, tiny little, they call them aerosol, like a dry fog of sulfur particles up there that act as a haze and block the sun.
What you're hearing is sound recorded during the Mount St. Helens eruption in Washington State in 1980. That was also a huge event, but scientists with the U.S. Geological Survey think Tambora may have pumped 80 times more debris into the atmosphere. In all, more than 35 cubic miles of debris blasted into the sky. Steger says Tambora probably combined with other climate trends, including El Nino and a pattern of weak solar activity.
The volcanic eruption was on top of other things that were conspiring to make it cool anyway. And this was like the coup de grace that pushed it over the edge into a record-breaking cooling in the Northern Hemisphere.
These days, climate change is a flashpoint. Scientists put out increasingly dire warnings, but a lot of Americans still don't believe it's real. In 1816, the confusion was even worse. People had no idea how climate worked, no way of linking Tambora to their failing crops and their frozen ponds. It was decades before researchers made the connection. Historians think the dark, bitter weather that summer may have contributed to a religious revival that swept the country. People feared an angry God was punishing them. Steger says there were all kinds of crazy theories.
They linked it to something as strange as Ben Franklin's experiments with electricity.
By late summer, people were reduced to eating nettles and wild turnips. Back at Old Sturbridge Village, Tom Kelleher says a lot of farms in what was then America's heartland were just abandoned.
And so an awful lot of people pulled up stakes and moved west to newer states like Ohio and Indiana, which had big growth spurts after 1816.
Historians say America's demographic center of gravity shifted that summer because of changes in the atmosphere no one could see or grasp. With our climate changing again now, scientists think we could see similar migrations, caused not by cold, but by rising temperatures, rising sea levels, and drought. For Here and Now, I'm Brian Mann.
Well, meanwhile, the Tambora eruption, as we heard, had a devastating impact on climate. But as we learned during an earlier segment, on art. Last year, we spoke with Gillan Darcy Wood, author of Tambora, The Eruption That Changed the World. He said you can see Tambora's impact in the reds and oranges of J.M.W. Turner's watercolors, in the bitter winters in Charles Dickens' fiction, in author Mary Shelley. In the summer of 1816, the poet Lord Byron gathered a group of friends, including Shelley, for a Swiss holiday, but they were trapped indoors by the terrible weather. And to pass the time, Mary Shelley wrote a new novel called Frankenstein. Gillan says the intense storms that lashed the Swiss Alps and Tambora's devastation may have inspired Shelley's description of the monster.
The monster, who, if you remember the novel, is wandering the highways and byways of Europe, and he's ostracized from towns and becomes an outcast. And to me, this is a kind of image of the suffering humanity in the aftermath of Tambora.
Gillan Darcy Wood, a terrific read. To hear our whole conversation, go to hereandnow.org.